Here's a new weapon to stem the crisis in Syria, the insurance industry.
Also, economic stimulus. Will the Fed turn it off or turn it up? Hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York.
And I'm Jeff Horwich in Los Angeles. This is the Marketplace Midday Update for Wednesday, June 20th. So it's been an interesting morning here. I've been thinking about Western hegemony in the marine insurance industry and what a powerful tool that is in stemming regional civil wars.
And so, yeah, exactly.
And also, why ordinary investors are so annoyed with the stock markets right now. How about you, Jeremy?
Well, we've got an interesting interview coming up with somebody in Egypt, a tour guide, talking about all the uncertainty about the future of that country. And of course, we will have the latest on what the Fed might do.
Sounds good.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
The Federal Reserve wraps up a meeting today in Washington, and the expectation is that policymakers will launch more monetary stimulus to boost the economy. Our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore reports now on what exactly the Fed can do.
Imagine that the Fed is at a rock concert with an economic amplifier. At the lowest level, zero is the option of doing nothing. Brian Sozzi, an analyst with independent research firm NBG Productions, describes the next step.
One would be continued what I call a jawboning of the market. They can extend lower from interest rates beyond 2014.
Turn the amplifier up to 2, and you have this option, according to Bloomberg LP economist Joe Bruce Willis.
Intentionally using inflation to get consumers to spend more and bring down the unemployment rate.
At 7, the Fed can continue its current stimulus called Operation Twist. That's designed to lower long-term interest rates, like for your mortgage. And at the high end, around 10, the Fed can buy up treasury bonds and mortgage securities. After that, the Fed may want to look to the movie This is Spinal Tap.
Where can you go from there? Where?
I don't know.
Nowhere, exactly. What we do is if we need that extra push over the cliff, you know what we do?
Put it up to 11.
11, exactly.
Luckily, the markets are used to the Fed getting noisy. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
For some analysis, let's bring in Julia Coronado. She's chief economist with the investment bank BNP Paribas, and she's with us this morning from her office here in New York. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, Julia, what do you think the Fed is going to do?
Well, I think what they are going to do is take some action. They're going to extend their current Operation Twist program in order to keep financial conditions supportive of the economy. And then I think that they might hint that they're trying to think through a mortgage purchase program to further ease credit conditions.
But each time they try to ease credit conditions, as you say, the big criticism is that it's not trickling down to the average person. The average person out there can't go out and get a mortgage. They just can't get the credit.
Well, and in this sense, we might be at a good time for the Fed to take action because we've seen the HARP program expanded. We've seen people that have been blocked from being able to refinance. And so if you give a little kicker to mortgage rates and bring them even lower, you'll get people that have already refinancing again, and those that are being reached by the new program refinancing, and it could create a nice virtuous circle.
Well, that leads me to my next question, which is how much of this is about the housing market? Every time the Fed steps in with stimulus, are they just trying to kickstart the housing market?
Well, they have made the argument that without participation from the housing market, we are unlikely to achieve above-trend growth, which is typically what we see in a recovery. And that is historically true. Housing is a critical piece of every recovery. It does respond to low interest rates and tends to be the sector that gets the economy moving. So it's been true historically. We haven't seen that this time around, and it certainly has been one of the reasons the recovery continues to be disappointing.
We'll be watching to see what they do. Julia Coronado, chief economist with the investment bank BNP Paribas. Thanks, as always.
It's always a pleasure.
Now to Egypt, where tens of thousands of protesters have returned to Tahrir Square in Cairo. They're responding to the country's recent presidential election between a member of the Muslim Brotherhood and a candidate tied to the former president, Hosni Mubarak. The official results are coming out tomorrow, but the Muslim Brotherhood candidate is already claiming victory. And, oh, by the way, the military generals have just stripped the presidency of much of its power. For more, let's welcome back to the show Afarah Omran. He's a tour guide in Cairo, and he joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, sir.
Well, how do you feel about what looks like a power grab by the Egyptian military, not allowing the Muslim Brotherhood to take full power after an election it looks like they won?
Yeah, I'm actually supporting the military, and I'm not with what the Muslim Brotherhood doing right now, especially when they declared after 5 hours from start count the voting that their candidate is the winner. So this is very strange, actually.
Okay, but you also did not support the Muslim Brotherhood, right? You didn't want them to win.
Yeah, I did not support them for many reasons, actually, yeah.
What is all of this uncertainty about the future there doing to the Egyptian economy? Is it functioning at the moment?
It is very critical time for the Egyptian economy, especially if you know that the stock market in 2 days lose about 15 billion Egyptian pound. And most of people, especially the investor from outside, they are a little bit concerned, especially when the Muslim Brotherhood declared that their candidate will be the next president of Egypt. Regardless where I'm working, like tourism, it's in a very bad condition right now.
Yeah, well, last time you and I spoke, you said that you couldn't go much longer without getting some business from tourists that were coming to Egypt and wanting to use you as a tour guide. How much longer can you go on like that?
Oh, you might be take about like 5-6 more months. I don't have received work since January 2011.
Wow.
I knew that some of the people who work in tourism start to sell their furniture. They don't have enough money to pay for the school for their children. There are some who already don't have money. There are some who did save some money, but the money will run out anyway. It won't be still forever.
Arafat Omran, a tour guide joining us from Cairo. Thank you so much.
You're most welcome. Thank you, too.
The U.S. and Europe are focused on diplomacy and sanctions to stem violence in Syria and perhaps force the current regime from power. One problem is Russia's alleged supply of arms to the government there. But Western diplomats have discovered a vulnerability. Every weapons-carrying ship has to carry insurance. And who sells the bulk of the world's marine insurance, Jeremy? It's us. The Europe, the EU, U.S., and Japan. The BBC's Steve Rosenberg is covering this new development from Moscow. Hello, Steve.
Hello there.
So tell me just what happened yesterday with this Russian ship, the Alade.
Well, this is a Russian cargo ship, which the British government suspects was on its way to Syria to deliver Russian helicopters. Now, both the British government and the American government have made it clear they don't want these kind of weapons to be delivered to Damascus. So the British government asked the insurance company, which had given insurance cover to the ship, to remove that cover. And the ship has now turned back, and we believe it's heading back to Russia.
And one critical point here is that that insurance company was based where?
This was a UK-based insurance company. And although the company itself, Standard Club, hasn't confirmed that it was the British government that asked it to remove that cover, we have information which suggests that it was indeed British government officials which told the insurance company that, according to UK information, this ship was carrying munitions and that breaks EU sanctions, and that the request was put in to remove insurance cover.
How significant a tactic could it be in keeping helicopters and other arms from making their way to Syria?
Well, I think it sends a very clear message to the Russian authorities that Britain, the United States and Europe are determined not to allow arms to filter through to Damascus. Now, the interesting question is, I mean, how important is Russian military aid to President Assad? And so I think there is a feeling in the West that it's important to cut off the supply of arms that may be coming from Russia to Syria.
Steve Rosenberg of the BBC, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Three hearings in Washington today, all dealing with the idea of trust in the stock markets, specifically why ordinary U.S. investors don't have very much right now. Senators are looking at the Facebook IPO. We'll get to that in a minute. In the House, lawmakers are wading into the general waning confidence of ordinary investors in our trading infrastructure. And the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, CFTC, is exploring the massive amount of high-frequency computerized trading that dominates market activity these days. To talk through why so many people are losing confidence in stock markets, we've got James Cox from the Duke University School of Law. Professor Cox, good morning.
Great to be here.
First of all, high-frequency trading. Remind us, just how fast is fast here, and why would this bother other traditional investors?
Well, for you and I, it's fast, And if you're one of these firms that's lucky enough to have their computers almost side by side with those of the trading firm, then you're even faster. Physical proximity, even within nanoseconds, put a tremendous advantage to the firms that engage in computerized trading, because they're actually closer to the source and they actually have a clearer view of the market than you and I would ever have.
So if I'm a pension fund, or if I'm just myself, say, looking to invest in my 401k, why is this hearing happening with the CFTC? Why am I bothered by so much high-frequency trading?
Well, the individuals who participate in the high-frequency trading will tell you that they provide liquidity and that the pension funds and the insurance companies and the retail investors are all the beneficiaries of that. What they leave out of that equation is that they're standing at a very privileged position with their computers, because they're able to have access by a fraction of a nanosecond knowledge of your trade, that is the retail investor's trade, the pension fund, the insurance company's trade coming in, and they can step in front of it.
Professor James Cox from the Duke Law School, good to talk with you. Thank you.
It's great to talk to you. Thank you very much.
On the other side of the U.S. Capitol, senators get to let off a little steam today over the mucked-up Facebook IPO. The Senate Banking Committee has a hearing on whether the initial public offering process is fair to the average Joe and Jane investor. From Washington, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
Vivek Wadhwa at Stanford Law says everyday investors lost out on the Facebook IPO. Long before public trading, only insiders could buy and sell shares in what are called secondary markets. And then, when the NASDAQ IPO came,
all of the high-end investors knew that Facebook was overpriced. They knew that its stock would likely drop. The only people who didn't know this were the public.
Only Facebook, its investment bank, and preferred investors reportedly got information about company weakness. Some of these whispers are allowed under a new law encouraging startups to go public. Wadhwa wants Congress to undo that. But finance professor Jim Angel at Georgetown says that exclusive whispering IPO club actually lets in the big mutual funds representing us.
We want large investors and the people who invest on behalf of you and me to have access to management.
They expect senators to look closely at the new relaxed IPO rules. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Jeremy, of course, you're familiar with the term doping, right?
Been talking
about
sure.
Lance Armstrong and stuff lately. So I'm going to coin a new term here, frogging. Right. You know what frogging is?
What is it?
So this is something that came up in horse racing very recently. According to the New York Times, horse racing officials were unaware of the fact that you could take the juice from the back of a waxy monkey tree frog from South America, something called dermorphin, that's the chemical. You could inject that into a horse. It's not exactly clear how it's applied to the horse, but it has some nifty effects on the animal when you do that. Namely, they become very excited, euphoric, and they can't feel pain. So you can imagine some advantages on the racetrack, which is why once a tip came in about this thing, more than 30 horses in 4 states tested positive for the waxy monkey tree frog substance. So I don't know. So
it's the new big thing.
I know. Well, that's the thing. They've caught up to it in horse racing. Next stop, bored suburban teenagers.
Who knows? Yeah. Well, Jeff, you know, in China, there's a lot of fake stuff that you can buy, electronics, designer clothes, DVDs. But to one guy there, those fake items were just child's play. So he decided to buy a fake American bank, the Atlantic Bank of Delaware, which actually sounds like a real bank, but which he bought for $60 million fake dollars back in fake January. And people were so surprised that someone with no banking experience could buy a prestigious bank like the Atlantic Bank of Delaware that this guy was given a political appointment. And the long story short is he's in real jail now.
Reminds me of all those fake Apple stores. Remember when those were opening up in China?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You can get a fake anything.
Just no limits.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
Let's get on to our midday update interview here, huh?
Yeah, the battle of the slice never seems to end, Jeff. Every month seems to bring new improved crusts, more cheese, and some two-for-one pizza deal. Mm-hmm. But the big chains are fighting back in Washington against proposed menu labeling plans that would say how many calories are in that deep dish triple meat treat.
Here to talk with us in today's Midday Extra, we have Alicia Kelso. She's editor of PizzaMarketplace.com. She's with us from Louisville, Kentucky, which is home, by the way, of Papa John's and Yum Brands, which owns Pizza Hut. Alicia, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So what exactly is the argument that these big pizza chains, let's call them Big Pizza, that they're bringing to Capitol Hill today?
A bunch of them got together, their franchisees and some corporates got together a few months ago and formed a coalition of sorts. And it mostly it is in response to the menu labeling portion of the health care law that is going into effect pretty soon here. Basically, that component of the law is going to require restaurants with 20 units or more to post their calorie information on menu boards prominently enough so customers can see it. So the argument that the pizza segment is making is pretty much that they're a unique beast. 90% of their customers, it's estimated, don't even come into the store to see the menu mm-hmm. labels that will be posted. So their argument is mainly that the component of the law is one size fits all, that they're different than burger joints, than, you know, donut joints, and they should have a little bit more flexibility.
Allow me to posit, though, Alicia, that perhaps the pizza joints are a little worried that a large pizza has a lot more calories than most people might think.
I can't deny that that's probably, you know, part of the impetus behind this. What's interesting about this, though, is McDonald's can make the same argument for a Big Mac. You know, I think consumers are savvy and smart enough that they know most of the choices that they're making at these restaurants aren't the healthiest some of the time. What's interesting about the pizza industry is there's another component, and that's the variable component. I think Patrick Doyle, who's the CEO of Domino's, once said that there are 34 million ways that you can order a pizza. Hmm. So, you know, the logistics get a little crazy, the cost gets a little crazy, and their big argument is it's an inefficient way to spend money for their franchisees, you know, upgrade their menu boards when in reality there's no way of possibly calculating the 34 million, you know, different pizzas.
Well, now I'm thinking about this in the context of another conversation we had on the show today about high-frequency trading and computers that execute, you know, zillions, gazillions of trades in a nanosecond. Something tells me that 34 million combinations, that we can find a way with technology to compute the calories in a pizza that people order. Am I crazy?
I don't think you're crazy at all. You know, on the other hand, the menu labeling law, as it's written right now, those major pizza joints will only really be required to post calorie information of the offerings that they choose to put on a menu. So, you know, I could order the most obscure pizza, but in reality, it's not going to really be affected by this.
Yeah, I must say, just personally, I love pizza, and no calorie count is going to convince me to eat pizza or not eat pizza. I mean, I know that they're high in calories, but I really don't care if it's, you know, 100 more or 200 more. Let me ask you one more thing, Alicia, before we let you go. What kind of pizza do you order when you order? What do you put on the pizza?
I like my black olives.
Sounds good.
That's not just a black olive pizza?
That's right. It's just a black olive.
What do you have to worry about?
Yeah, that's right. That'd probably be low on
the olives are high in salt, so.
Okay. You could do a lot worse than that these days, yeah. I think. Alicia Kelso, editor of PizzaMarketplace.com. Thanks for joining us on the Midday Extra.
Okay. Thanks for having me.
So now let's talk about some public services, transit and post offices.
Apple's new operating system for iPhones and iPads has drawn plenty of praise, but one group that is not so happy is public transit riders. From the Transportation Nation desk at WNYC here in New York, Andrea Bernstein explains.
When Apple VP Scott Forstall unveiled the company's new operating system last week, he was breathless with enthusiasm.
Next is maps.
Not included, transit directions. BART trains? Not there. Metro? Not there. The T? Not there.
I was, first off, kind of surprised.
Joshua Robin is innovation director for the Massachusetts Bay Transportation Authority.
Well, for the last couple of years, it's been a huge benefit to our riders to have transit as an option.
iPhones have been relying on Google Maps, which do include transit directions. But now that Apple is working on its own system, it dropped transit. Pro-transit groups started a petition to get Apple to reconsider. Apple isn't commenting beyond what Forstall said at the announcement.
And so instead of trying to build those ourselves, we are going to integrate and feature and promote your apps for transit right within the Maps app in iOS 6.
So, for a while at least, you'll have to download them yourselves. In New York, I'm Andrea Bernstein for Marketplace.
U.S. Postmaster General Patrick Donahoe recently said the Postal Service could be going the way of Greece if Congress didn't pass a restructuring plan to close a multi-billion-dollar deficit. Last month, Donahoe outlined the plan to close half of all mail handling facilities over the next 2 years. But this type of postal austerity doesn't come without a cost to customers, Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports.
This year's closings mean about 20% of first-class mail that now gets delivered to regional destinations overnight will take 2 days.
It's going to slow down the mail.
Sally Davidow is a spokeswoman for the American Postal Workers Union. Once all the targeted mail facilities are closed, the union will lose 28,000 members through attrition and buyouts. And Davidow says customers can expect delays in deliveries of medicine, newspapers, and magazines.
And then there's just the regular correspondence that people get. You know, the bills, the statements, the checks they want to send in. All that's going to be slowed down.
But few people depend on the post office for overnight mail, says Sue Brennan of the Postal Service.
Most people think it takes 2, 3, 4 days for a piece of mail to get delivered anywhere, and that's certainly not the case. But for those procrastinators out there, we would suggest they give a day or two extra.
Slower service is one thing, but to tackle the post office's growing deficit, prices will have to go up as well. Leif Richler is a former chairman of the Postal Regulatory Commission. He says the combination of service cutbacks and higher prices will create business opportunities for companies like UPS and FedEx.
The Postal Service is competitive there, too, with overnight mail, express mail. It just will cost more to mail a letter. You won't be able to put a 44-cent stamp on it and hope it gets there in the morning.
For the most part, newspaper and magazine distributors say they recognize the Postal Service has to downsize to adapt to new realities. Jim O'Brien heads up Postal Affairs for Time Incorporated. He knows when the post office slows down.
We have what we call seeds in different zip codes throughout the country. We have 700 people that every week tell us when they get their Time or Sports Illustrated or People magazines. So we watch those seeds very closely.
O'Brien is expecting some early glitches as facilities are closed, but eventually he predicts his magazines will get there more efficiently and on time. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
There are a lot of industries that say protecting the environment hurts the bottom line, but a report out today spotlights one industry with a different view. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports.
The new report by the Outdoor Industry Association finds that every year, Americans spend nearly $650 billion on outdoor recreation. Spokesperson Eileen Thompson puts that in perspective.
Americans spent more money on outdoor recreation than they did on pharmaceuticals, on motor vehicles, and on household utilities every year.
And only about 20% of the money is spent on stuff like backpacks and bikes. Jim Klug is with Yellow Dog Fly Fishing Adventures in Bozeman, Montana.
While the money that's spent on gear and equipment is certainly significant, the real economic impact occurs when people get outside and use the equipment that they've bought.
Most of the dollars spent on the great outdoors go to things like guides, hotels, and restaurants. Even companies that don't profit directly find that proximity to the outdoors can be a competitive advantage. Consider Rally Software in Boulder, Colorado.
Almost every candidate that we talk to has multiple offers, and it is absolutely a battle to get the top talent.
John Landau is Rally's director of recruiting. He recently interviewed a job candidate now working in Silicon Valley.
He said he's tired of the rat race in Silicon Valley. He's looking to have access to the outdoors, but yet still work for a compelling, innovative technology company.
Like the tech sector, jobs linked to outdoor recreation are somewhat recession-proof. The study shows that between 2006 and 2011, the outdoor recreation industry grew by an average of 6% a year. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
And a new study suggests a potent factor in crime rates across countries. It's not income or income inequality, Jeremy, the usual suspects. According to researchers at the Universities of Oregon and Kansas, the number of people who believe in hell is a strong predictor of crime. More hell, crime goes down. Interesting. Anyway.
There you go. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Jeff Horwich in Los Angeles. This is the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.